Item 12, from Corporation Counsel, submitting an informational monthly report on an update on the status of pending litigation. This item is also considered by the Committee on Finance, Personnel, and Audit and is informational only unless otherwise directed by the committee.
Mr. Chairman, not a whole lot to talk about, but I do have a couple points. First of all, with respect to items 3 and 4 on the list, both of those cases, the lead cases there, are in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has established oral argument on both of those cases for October 1st on the same day, so they've combined the argument both in the Medicare Part B case with the pension multiplier case. So they'll both be heard that day. You're certainly welcome to go watch. I don't know that I'll be able to, but it's at 9:30 on October 1st in Madison. How long it will be thereafter before we receive a decision, of course, is anybody's guess. It could be as early as early in 2015. It could be as late as this time next year. So the only other thing I have to add is the new cases that we have added to the list, items 18 and 19. Item 18, and both of these received media attention, so you're probably aware of them. Item 18 is a lawsuit related to a patient death at BHD. This was referenced earlier in the earlier item. This is the first lawsuit. Well, it's not the first lawsuit. We had a prior lawsuit involving a patient death. But this is the first lawsuit of the matters I was referring to earlier. We have probably, and if my memory serves, either 4 or 5 serious claims that are pending that are not yet in suit. And if you'd like a briefing on those, I'm not prepared to do that today, but I can certainly do that next meeting if you'd like. This case was filed in federal court. It's filed by two law firms working together. Jonathan Safran is the attorney who gets the most media attention because he is representing a number of families in the community who have claims similar to this against the county and against the city of Milwaukee. He's working with another lawyer who specializes in nursing home malpractice cases. As of course, BHD as a hospital is not dissimilar. It's not the same, but it's not dissimilar from that context. So they're working together. Our intention is this is a case that's not covered by our insurance with Mutual because it relates to patient care at BHD. So any defense costs and any liability is a county tax levy liability. Our office believes that the size of this case and the scope of the case, the nature of the allegations, the resources needed are beyond what we can do. We don't have anyone in the office who has any specialization in medical malpractice, for example. So it's our intention to hire outside counsel, and you will be seeing, I believe, a contract, or the board will be seeing a contract in the September cycle. We are initially doing a less than $100,000 contract only because that's all the funds we have. I know this contract will be more than $100,000 in the end, but I don't have the funds to allocate to it right now, but at some point you will see that. And so our intention is to sign a contract with two firms working together, the White Hirschbeck Dudek firm and the firm of Emil Banks and Associates. Emil Banks is a certified DBE firm to work with White Hirschbeck. Both firms have experience in civil rights. Both firms have experience in medical malpractice. Both firms are firms that the Mutual uses for Mutual cases, and so they're familiar with them, even though it's not a Mutual case. Our office is familiar with both of these firms. I've known Emil Banks and Charlie Ball for probably 30 years, 25 to 30 years. White Hirschbeck has had a lot of success with cases the Mutual has assigned to them, primarily out of the jail and the sheriff's department, similar setting, if you will, legal setting. And so we think it's a really good team to put together to handle this case, and so that's our intention. I'm working on the contract right now. Before I move on, if you have questions about that case, so.
Supervisor Deskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're at the end of a long meeting, so you know I don't want to belabor too much, but yes, maybe next month you could bring us up to date on all of the cases that we were going to reserve the $3.5 million for and kind of give us an explanation as to why.
Sure. Happy to do that.
There. And I guess I would like to also. Some point when the chair might think it's appropriate is to give our committee all of a better handle on how this new law at BHD is going to affect who is responsible for the liabilities that go on out there. I mean, we don't, on the one hand, we've lost a lot of control. On the other hand, it seems like we, you know, like to get learn more about how that balances. And maybe when we have a light agenda, that's a pretty heavy topic. That's going to take some time. But I would like, I think we need to know that.
Yeah.
And the last time when they tried to explain that at the bill at IGR, we had a host of people up here, and none of them could really explain the bill, including all the attorneys. And then it occurred to me, talking about these medical malpractice cases, are we able to tie into the patient's compensation fund at all for these things?
Because
I mean, they're going to be perhaps in excess of $1 million. There's $1 billion sitting there, in the patient's compensation fund. And it would seem to me that, we should be able to tie into that somehow. And if we can't, maybe we should be talking to some legislators for next session about ways that Milwaukee County, BHDN's new mental health board can tie into patient's compensation, because there is over $1 billion just sitting there doing nothing, and it's going to continue to do nothing. And then my last thing is, do we ever fire the people who are responsible for these patient deaths, or do they just sort of keep coming to work and keep paying them and keep handling the lawsuits? I guess that's more of a rhetorical question.
The exec is in complete control right now.
Well, and he was in control before, too, and
yeah.
I get that.
Now he's in complete.
Yeah, he was in day-to-day control, but does anybody ever bear any responsibility for anything? And for these cases that you're going to explain to us, I would like to know, when you do the explanation, did anybody ever get fired?
Okay. We'll have a... That may actually be the BHD series of cases. Well, this is the only case, but then there's the claims, right?
Right.
So something outlining those, that's probably deserving of its own item, because it goes beyond litigation to include those that are just claims at this point. And we can notice that for closed. Correct?
Sure. Just a quick response on a couple of these things. I'm happy to do the background on the claims, no problem with that at all. On the mental health board fiscal issue, and this is just simplistic thinking off the top of my head, but it seems to me that clearly the county is always going to be liable as a backstop because of the state statute. The question really is, where does the money get budgeted or allocated in my mind? And so the question is, let's assume you have $3 million of liability, just to pick that number. Whether it comes out of the county budget separate from the mental health board as a tax levy, or whether you put it in the mental health board budget and increase their budget by $3 million to cover it, either way, assuming a relatively flat tax levy, it's sort of you're less $3 million to spend on the county side either way, it seems to me. But I'm getting ahead of us. So, I'm also getting into fiscal, which is not my area. So,
all right.
So anyway, let me move on to 19, unless...
Supervisor Weisha.
Oh, well, if Corp Counsel wants to do another one, but I just had questions on just two other matters, but
okay.
Whatever order he'd like to address me.
We can. We haven't gotten to 19 yet, but if there's one that's earlier on you want to ask about?
Yes. If you just give us a quick update on number 14.
There's not a lot that I know of that has happened in that case. In federal court, things... Well, in any court, things don't move real quickly. The county filed its answer. The parties are required to make mandatory filings with the court. I don't know. I don't think those have been made yet. I'll have to double check on that. I was going to ask the attorney handling that case with outside counsel to be here, but he couldn't be here today because he's covering a deposition of Kerry Mitchell in a different case. And so he can't be here today. And if he could have been here, I would have had him here, because I anticipated you asked this question last cycle. So I'm hoping to get him here next cycle. Then he can answer the questions better than I can, to be honest with you. All I can tell you from my personal knowledge is not much has happened. It's just...
Right. No, I would just hope that we would engage it and not drag our feet and resolve it as soon as possible. I understand the courts don't always move as fast as we would like. And then on number
seven. That would be a
good
subject for a closed session next month if you can
be
here.
And then on 17, if you could give us an update on that.
Well, the case in which the journal sought the release of the records is done. The judge ordered the release of the records back to Milwaukee County. And so what's happened is our office has retained a firm called Legal People. It's basically a firm that has contract attorneys. And Mr. Bargan was familiar with them from his prior practice. And we have a team, I believe it's four attorneys, it might be five, working physically in our office, in our conference room, going through the records. He has allocated, at least for so far, an $85,000 contract to do that work. The goal, as I've heard it, is that some initial releases will be made early in next month, probably of less interesting information, frankly. And as they get to the more sought-after information, the so-called, you know, the emails and those things, the goal is to have all of that done by the end of September. And Mr. Bargan's statement to me, which I'll pass on to you, is that if it looks like it's not going to be done by the end of September, rather than extending the deadline later, he's going to try and put more resources on it to hold to the deadline. So we're really trying very hard to get this done by the end of September and have the records available for release.
I guess this $85,000 cost, I don't quite get the point where we have to sift through this stuff. That why aren't we just throwing it up on the website, and you know, if somebody wants to look through it for 12 hours and pick out what they want, but having just that open access to it, why aren't we just doing the low cost option here?
Two answers. First of all, this is pretty low cost. I think we're paying something like $47 an hour for this service. So, as attorneys go, that's fairly low cost. In terms of throwing everything up on the website, we can't, because everything we received is not a public record. There are purely personal matters in there. I mean, pictures of dogs and cats, you know, pets, things like that. You know, I mean, because we got hard drives. It's everything that was on that person's computer. And as everybody knows, you have personal stuff on your computer. It might be personal phone calls. It might, you know, phone numbers. It may be, you know, emails with somebody about personal items, not work-related. And so we have an obligation to redact out things that are not public records about public business. We also have to redact out, you know, any personally identifiable health information if that's there. We have to redact out attorney-client privilege communications, because I know those are included, communications between people and attorneys in our office, prior corp counsels and things like that. So those are privileged and have to be redacted out. I suspect that most of this information will be public. I don't think the redactions are going to be a large volume, but they still have to be made.
Is it possible that you could provide us with sort of like just a list of the things that would be pulled out? Because I've always been concerned about this redacting anything. I don't, you know, I've done open records requests on the, you know, when Walker was county executive, and like, oh yeah, you get this, you know, half sheet of paper. Well, of course the criminal is never gonna, you know, of course he's gonna black out the stuff that incriminates him. So, you know, I would just like to know just what are, you know, the categories of things that, you know, are being put out there, or I should say blacked out, and not being released, because I've always been under the impression that, you know, if you do things, you know, if you're in the public eye and, you know, you do things and, you know, whether you like it or not, you know, the public has access to it, and that's why you need to be extremely careful about, you know, what you write and send and stuff like that.
Well, fundamentally, that's not the law. If you use your county computer to send a personal email to your wife, to be simple about it, that's not a public record. Should it be? Maybe, but that would require a change in the public records law. It's not a public record. And so we have an obligation to not do that. There's a Supreme Court precedent that, you know, emails of government employees on things that are not public business, even though they're using governmental resources, if it's truly a private, non-public subject that's being discussed, are not public records. And so we would be violating the public records law by releasing that information. And so we have an obligation to redact. And the categories are the ones I gave. And you know, one of the reasons that we wanted to go to outside law firm to do this work is to try and address the concern over objectivity in the redaction process. And so we have completely stepped away from that, and our office as well. And so we're just taking everything the DA's office gives us, giving it to this team, and letting them go through it.
Just to follow up on that, so, but under this scenario, if there are hundreds or thousands of emails that are campaign emails but do not include other public business, they will not be made available?
Yes, if it truly is not public business. Now, what I would tell you is that our default or our starting point is, if you're using a county device, the presumption is it's public business, and it's has to be shown clearly not to be, to exclude it. So there's gray areas, of course. You have a campaign person writing to an elected official, and they're talking about the campaign, but they're also talking about, in that email, county business as it relates to the campaign. That's probably going to be a public record. If they're talking about, well, we need to raise this much money for this fundraiser, that's probably not. There's no mention of county business in there. And so that's kind of the line I think we try to draw. If you're talking about, you know, in the media there's been discussion about emails related to O'Donnell Park, as an example. I think, you know, if those emails are, no matter, you know, if they're between a county person and a campaign person, is it related to O'Donnell Park, that's a public email. I don't think there's much question about that. But there are, certainly could be campaign-related emails that are not, because they don't talk about county business. They talk about their opponent or something. I don't know.
But that
I haven't seen any of these, just so you know.
You're talking there about use of county equipment. What about if, for instance, you were imaginative enough to install your own private system? I mean, are there different rules that govern that? And is that in and of itself legal?
Well, we also have been received hard drives and emails on non-county computers, non-county equipment, and non-county email systems, whether it's the so-called secret router or whether it's, you know, Google or Yahoo or something like that. Those, I think, the presumption is sort of that they're private unless we can show that they're public. And so I think we turn it sort of the other way around. Now, I think the test is still pretty much the same. You know, if a county person is using, if you, Supervisor Broderick, are using your county phone, assuming you have one, and you are sending an email to a non-county person, but you're discussing county business, that's a public record. Now, it's one of the reasons we've advised you to not to use. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. If you're using your personal phone and sending an email to someone, but you're discussing county business, that's a, should be a public record. And so that's one of the reasons we've advised elected officials to try and separate devices, if you will. Use one device for all your public business and use another device for non-public business. But if you use a non-public device, even if it's a private email account and you're a governmental official and you're doing governmental business, that's a public record. And so it doesn't really matter where the communication or the document resides. If it's residing on a private email system or a public email system, if it's discussing public business from a public official, it's a public record.
But the other question was the installation of a private system to avoid public disclosure illegal? Because I've never heard that question addressed.
I'm not sure that the installation is illegal. It's the failure to retain that would be illegal. So, you know, if you send a text to the supervisor sitting next to you discussing public business on your personal phones, that's a public record. And so the liability comes when you don't retain that. It's not necessarily a liability for using a personal phone to do it. It's the liability for not retaining it. And so it's the way the law is set up, that's the liability. It's the failure to retain that record. It's not the way you created it. It's the failure to retain it. And then, because then it's no longer available to people to see.
Well, then I think I've read over that statute a ton. It's the intention to evade the public record. Well, that it, and I think that, you know, when you set up a private email system, a secret email system, I think that's you're trying to evade retaining public records.
Well, and I'd have to defer to the district attorney on criminal,
exactly.
On criminal law. There may be some other statute somewhere, you know, that would fit that, misconduct in office or something. I don't know. I'm just saying it's not a violation of the public records law to do that. That's all I'm saying.
Well, just to refocus, to come back, I think there, you know, this stuff needs to be done, and you know, thinking I don't you know, waiting till October or whatever, all this kind of stuff. Honestly, you know, some of this stuff is, you know, getting to be quite stale as far as when it was actually you know, done. So the sooner the better. I think this, you know, everybody, if there's nothing there, you know, fairness to Scott Walker, then fine, it should be done and over with, and he shouldn't have to wait till October. But if people want these records, they should be able to get them, whether it's, you know, August, September, or whatever, and as soon as possible. And I don't think that we should,
I think it's
I think the point needs to be made that now we have to spend $85,000 for these people who claim that they're holier than thou, you know, Eagle Scouts and everything, and they forget that 21 people, I think, have been granted immunity. 6 people went, you know, were convicted of crimes, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, now they want to claim that they have some kind of special right to privacy. You want privacy, don't commit crime. It's as simple as that.
All right. Item 19.
I just want to follow up one point. I'm sorry, just to clarify an issue that I think has been raised. I mean, if we take it out of the context of Governor Walker and just talk about an employee, if an employee is excessively using their computer for personal stuff, they're on Facebook all the time, their county computer, they're on Facebook all the time, they're sending personal emails, whatever, the employer, the county, has a right to discipline that person for that. As, you know, it's like wasting time doing anything else that's not work. And so we have a right to discipline them. And if we use, for example, some of those emails as part of the discipline process, then once that discipline process is done, the information, the evidence we used as part of that process would become a public record. But in the absence of that kind of discipline, those emails are not public records. They only become public records in the process of using the discipline, doing the discipline. So I think that's it's not the exact analogy, but it's similar.
So if there were campaign emails that are not public records now because they were personal, they're construed to be personal, but they were sent on public computers, they will be excluded from the public record now unless we were to utilize them to pursue a recovery against former employees, and then they could become public?
Perhaps. I don't know. I mean, I think everybody involved in this is no longer with us, so there wouldn't be any discipline issue. I don't know about recovery.
Is it? I mean, if it were a crime, wouldn't it be related?
Well, if
to
the
that?
DA used them, that's how the Rheinfleisch emails got released. Essentially, yeah. They were part of the criminal prosecution. So,
okay. Will you? So, to Supervisor Weisshen's question, will you give us some description of the types of records that were excluded, or will it simply say it was not a public record? Well, I mean, will it say we found a number of, you know, campaign emails on public computers, but they were excluded because they were not a public record? Would there be any description?
We can. That's not part of our obligation under the public records law, but if the committee wants that as an information item, I assume we could create some sort of document to categorize that.
I think the public would be served by it, because
the categories are what I said before, but I can try and get more detail on that.
What's clear to me is that most of what people are expecting isn't going to be released because it's going to be determined to be a private record, even if it was sent on a public system or using public computer.
Or what you may get is holes in communications. You'll have a series of emails where some of the emails are public and then some are not,
right.
And so you'll have gaps.
Just to the oligarchs I was mentioning earlier.
Well, just in that contract for $85,000, isn't there a directive to the company that this is what you have to redact under whatever the contract? Or
well, No, not directly, because the directive is the statute. And so these are attorneys who are familiar with public records law, and so they apply the statute the same way we would. And so we aren't trying. I mean, the last thing I want to do is have our office trying to be telling them, release these records, don't release these records. We want them to exercise their legal judgment on what is appropriate. Now,
well that's why I'd like to, you know, as Chairman Lipscomb pointed out, that, you know, I would just like to know the categories. So, you know, I don't want people to think that, yeah, it's redacted because it's, you know, go get a gallon of milk, when, oh, yeah, it's really, it's campaign-related stuff, and it's, here, go illegally coordinate with these people, but we've decided that's private. You know, I don't want to, you know, cover up their crimes.
All right. 19.
Item 19 is another new lawsuit that was filed. It was also in the media, got a lot of play because of the press, the media event that the plaintiff's attorneys conducted on the courthouse steps of the federal courthouse when they filed it. It relates to a motor vehicle accident where a deputy struck another car. Ms. Weicker was the driver of the other car. She sustained substantial injuries in the accident. She has a claim for personal injuries related to the accident. That's pretty straightforward. And if that's all this case was about, we would be here today with a settlement for you. Those responsibilities, those liabilities are limited by statute to a maximum of $250,000. She's incurred about $190,000 in medical bills alone. But this lawsuit is a bigger lawsuit than that. It's a federal civil rights lawsuit that alleges false arrest. It alleges cover-up. It alleges a code of silence as a matter of practice and policy on the behalf of the Sheriff's Department, encouraged by the sheriff personally to do this consistently, not just to her, but across the board. I think allegations over the top, but in any event, clearly false. But in any event, those are the allegations. And so it's a very substantial lawsuit in terms of the nature of the allegations that are being made. This case has been assigned by the Mutual also, because this is covered by the Mutual, to the White Hirschbeck firm to handle. And they have not answered. We were just served yesterday or the day before with the lawsuit. So I asked the Sheriff's Office, the reason they've been sitting here patiently is because there was a question raised at agenda setting by Chairman about responding to incidents like this, and whether, you know, in this incident, MPD cop was responded to the incident, and the question was raised of, well, why didn't the MPD cop handle the criminal investigation with respect to the operation while under the influence? And so I asked the inspector to come so that he can answer that question for you, assuming you're still interested in the answer. Sure. So.
Yeah, the question had to do with sort of separation of duties. The fact that MPD would question the deputy, it made sense that they would also handle the other party in the case, so that you could, so that it would be beyond such an allegation.
Thank you. And just Inspector Bailey again.
And
just
I'd like you not to talk about this case. Just talk about, you know, your practice policy in general.
I asked D.A. Weber to come up because the type of career I had was not OWI enforcement. I was a detective. I had a little different career. He's done plenty of OWI. He ran that division, ran the patrol, expressway patrol division for years and years. So if we get into real OWI questions, you're going to watch me back slowly away. So the question, I suppose, is really one of the appearance of not an impropriety, but the appearance of there's a word I'm searching for. If I get the exact word, I'm going to give it to you. It's in our code of conduct. I'm just struggling for it, right? Impartiality. It's not a question of impropriety, it's a question of impartiality, or at least the appearance of impartiality. An example might be, I'm a law enforcement officer, I work on Oakton Lane in Greendale. That's where I live, right? So I work for the sheriff's office. And my next door neighbor's house is robbed, and I've known my next door neighbor for 20 years. Is it right for me to just take my sheriff's badge and walk next door and start the investigation of that residential burglary? The answer is, that's probably not right. Do I have the jurisdiction to do it? Sure, I'm a county deputy sheriff. Do I have the skills and abilities to do it? Yes, but somebody might question my impartiality in that the crime victim is well known to me and we've extended, you know, a long-term relationship. So that's just to make that point. So that's really what I think we're talking about. So the best practice, generally in law enforcement, is to not investigate matters where that is apparent, where the impartiality issue raises its head. And sometimes that can be a little subtle. And it's not standard. I mean, there are some agencies, for example, with officer-involved shootings. Can you impartially investigate an officer-involved shooting from your agency? Well, our profession struggles with that. And we all know agencies that investigate all of their own officer-involved shootings, whether a death results or not. In the sheriff's office, we don't. We do investigate some officer-involved shootings, but the moment a citizen is hit, when somebody's struck with a round, we don't investigate those, and we haven't for a long time. At least under Sheriff Clark, we have.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to stop for a second because I'm getting a little nervous about this. I wanted to do this in open session, but I'm becoming very nervous about it. And so I think either we should go into closed session to answer this question because the tapes are running, and this Mr. DeBailey's going to get deposed at some point.
I don't know how wide this question is.
Do it next
is.
Month.
I,
next
we
cycle.
Can have
sure.
a talk about it. Or, yeah.
Whatever
if
you like. But
want
I just
to follow up as well. Okay.
Okay.
I'll take advice of counsel on that one. Seeing nothing further, we're adjourned.
Thanks. That's fine. I'm just fine.